So today I'm going to be talking about interfacing with global knowledge. I'm going to bookend the talk with a couple of slides, but let me give a little bit of context about where this work is coming from. My next book is going to be called Memory Practices in the Sciences and follows a series of sciences over the last 200 years. You're going to get a relatively telescoped part of some of the argument, but let me give you a couple of sources that I'll be drawing on. I'll refer to this in a second, this picture. The first is a book that I've read just last year, which I just fell in love with, by Leslie Kirk, called Coins, Bodies, Games and Gold, which is a structural poetics reading of Herodotus. What she does there, she takes the unusual fact that after the invention of coinage in about 660 BC, around that time, there was virtually no discourse about it. People were not talking about the coins. There was, however, she discovers through Herodotus, a very rich political discourse that was going on in other registers. And this register was the language of metals, the purity of gold and silver and bronze. It was the language of women, and it was a language of games. All right, given that we've got an extra 3 minutes, I'll just one more preparatory remark on that. It suggests to me a way of reading databases and trying to understand the levels and ways in which political and social discourses get folded into databases. And I'm going to suggest a kind of poetics and a kind of structuralist poetics reading of that. My other influence in this, as you'll see during the talk, before this august body of embodied footnotes, I will be footnoting Lev Manovich's work and especially his ideas on the database as a symbolic form. Now this is a note, £5 note, Benjamin Franklin to counterfeit his death, with a picture of a set of leaves on it. The leaves were chosen because it was believed that that would be the one thing that couldn't be counterfeited was nature. The one thing that is inherently incredibly particular, incredibly singular is nature in all its forms, be it the snowflake or the leaf. Now I'm going to just set up a paradox on that. I'm going to set up a tension within this banknote that I'm going to come back to at the end of the lecture, and I'll try and connect it up. The tension is that the Franklin note, while it embodies this pure particularity, the end point of the tree of life, and I'm going to talk a lot about the tree of life today. So in the one sense it's the incredibly particular, but it's also the degree zero of information. Banknotes do not share information. They rip things out of context, and when you exchange banknotes, it's precisely you don't care about the context, you just want the money. So it's a token that you're exchanging, which is the other end of information. I think the degree zero is a good term, it says. Now, we think of the tree of life. The tree of life is a dominant metaphor within the biological sciences, I would guess, over the last 200 years. I'm not going to give you the full intellectual history of it, which is closely tied to its own set of information technologies. This is the Carnegie Archive, but basically you're storing things in boxes in a pretty hierarchical form. You've got an index form which matches the form of the tree itself. Tree of Life goes back a long way. This is a Celtic inscription representing the Tree of Life. You might be more familiar with the religious inscriptions. This is Adam and Eve partaking. No, I guess they've already eaten. They look well fed. And you see various flora and fauna are often gathered around them in the garden in the biblical representations. The more canonical form, which you'll recognize, this is the Simpsons version of the Tree of Life, where we start off from single one-cell forms at the very bottom of the page, and then we go up temporally until we hit Newt's, Jaws 3, and Wolfman at the very end point of evolution. And this is a metaphor that biologists are very comfortable with. It's a great way of organizing your data because it not only gives you a representational medium, it also gives you a temporal grounding of it. You know, you start at the bottom and you work your way up. It also allows you to represent particularity in a really nice way because every branch of the leaf can then be broken down into twigs. Each twig can be broken down into sub-twigs. subtwigs, and at the end of every subtwig there's a leaf, which is full information. Here's a more standard representation today of that same tree of life. This is a standard quiddistic representation. Already a couple of problems on that, but I won't go through those in detail. But we're starting with the archaeobacteria and the eubacteria right at the start, and then we're kind of building up until we get animals and fungi. One of the problems seems to be that humans are closer related to fungi than they are to other animals in some ways. But the terminal clades appear about a billion years ago. So again, we've got a very strong time grounding for it. There's an argument within biology about whether that time grounding can actually be written into the tree. I won't really go into that right now. Now, the metaphor, and what I want to point to today, is that the metaphor has become a very tortured one in many ways. This I particularly like, just grabbed it off the web this morning. I don't know who it's from, but the tree of life for three pillars. So you've got an incredible mixture of metaphors going on here, that somehow the tree has three pillars supporting it. Severity, mildness, and mercy. I'll throw myself on your mercy. Here's another representation. This is logically exactly the same as the tree of life. It can be read as the tree with that single point in the center, but already you can see that it's not fitting very easily into the tree network. Just in representational terms, a huge problem when you consider the degrees of particularity that are coming into the tree of life right now. However, where am I? Hope this fires up correctly. I always have troubles with Adobe in presentations. Here's a more common representation. Now, let's step back a little. The reason why I'm giving you all these representations of the tree of life is because they're ways of holding information, they're ways of organizing your information, which I'm going to argue is very tied to the state of information technology we have, as well as it's tied to our knowledge about the world, and there's a kind of growing together of the two. And I'm also going to be building towards a conclusion about particularity and globality. Okay, as Adobe fires itself up, what we're going to see here is a more, what we're not going to see here. Let's try and get that full screen. You're still not going to see it all that clearly. Okay, what you see here is a more modern representation of the tree of life. You already recognize that it's becoming more of a smudge than a tree. And it's got various pockets in there that are just sort of hanging off. You know, you've got your...
what is it down there?
I can't see, but it's... I think it's... Oh, it's the viruses, that's right. This family down here is the viruses. Viruses are very unfortunate because they don't fit into the dominant model, this dominant information metaphor, because you can't trace them back to single ancestors. It's uncertain whether they're reverse evolution or straightforward evolution. They're just a mess, so they just become a circle in the middle of it. And the tree itself becomes much more of a navigation through space. And that navigation through space metaphor is one I'm going to be coming back to in a few minutes. This is a picture from a site called the Tree of Life, which is a huge and wonderful site being created by the Madison Brothers at Wisconsin, I think. What they're trying to do is build up a vast distributed database which is going to contain all information about all the world species, readily accessible in JPEGs, movies, all the articles you can get up there online, all the representations you can get, all the knowledge about those fields, molecular sequences and so on and so forth. Now when they chose this icon to represent the tree of life, you can see again that we've got an interesting merger going on here. In one sense it's a tree, which is sort of starting down there, which is the central node of the computer network rather than the central node of life. And you also have, it's very unclear where the root of this tree is. You're sort of losing that as you go along. You've got all of these tentacles going out. And what you're getting is a representational form, which is a pretty good merger between what it's like to navigate on the web and a theory about the nature of life and where life comes from and how to describe the history of life. That's a typical, this is a representation of the Tree of Life website. That's a typical set of nodes that you'll follow through. Nodes themselves being called leaves, leaf of the tree by the time you get to the very top of the screen. So clearly a powerful organizing metaphor, but the tree itself is causing problems. Okay, so how do people theorize that? I'm not going to... I'm not going to go into details about the scientific arguments about this. The reason that I want to draw attention to them a little bit, though, is to show that, in fact, in the sciences, we're getting very much the same set of concerns which are being expressed in postmodernism, you know, those of us who mock scientists, as within the scientific community. You're getting the same sets of concerns are coming up in interesting ways. Here we have... let's see. Yes. The bottom paragraph down there, because this is an editorial, blah, 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 the author spoke of two lateral contributions to evolution. Are there any other evidences of the fusion of other branches on this shrub of life? And it suggests changing the tree to a shrub. Now, the basic argument behind this, the move from the tree to the shrub, is that genes have the unfortunate ability to jump between species and even to jump between genus. So where in the old days you had the idea that there was a single tree, and it seems intuitively clear that's how we should be organizing our information, it's not actually a representation of historical process. It's an extremely good representation of record-keeping procedures. Okay. Note to self. So within this, we've seen that... Okay, this is the first half of the talk. What we've seen so far is that you're building up... a mechanism which allows you to give a complete and particular description at the end of the tree of life of every leaf on the tree of life. So it's a move towards incredible particularism. Now, the main point of my talk today is I want to show that there's a tension within global information infrastructures between this drive to particularism and an implosive move, a drive to collapse things down to single values where the particular goes away, so that what we end up with is a form of exchange which is much more like the much more like the Franklin note. So let me give a bit of context to that otherwise outrageous remark. This is a site, it's actually a really interesting site about biodiversity sciences today. Here we are. Yeah. Biodiversity science is actually a particularly interesting area because it's a site at which numerous scientific disciplines are being forced to come together, are being forced to exchange data, and they have very different agendas going on. And so the battle about data and data standards, the battle about the data construction, is also a political battle, and inherently a political battle. I'll just pull out the quote there from the paragraph that starts, for example, a dandelion and a giant redwood can be seen to represent a richer collection of characters in total and so greater biodiversity value than another pair of more similar species, a dandelion and a daisy. This shows how the phenotypic characters or the genes that code for them could provide a currency of value for biodiversity. Pursuing this idea, we will then need to maximize richness and the character currency within the conservationist bank of managed or protected areas. A few things to point out about that. One is that the very reference to a currency, to a single currency, that is a huge problem. One community will argue that what we should be trying to save is genetic information. If genetic information is at the heart of your biodiversity effort, then you'll have a certain kind of conservation strategy whose utopian dream is actually, well, we can just store gene sequences on computers and then just rip them out whenever we need them, so we needn't worry too much. A logic of that particular kind of currency is also that there's no point in saving rare species. What you need to save is the common species that are earlier in the evolutionary tree because they can spawn multiple forms of life over time. They've already proved that they could do that. The second form of currency is species diversity, which is very different, but it's more our aesthetic sense of what should be measured. And the species diversity is like you like to keep the pretty things, the bright things, the charismatic megafauna, as they're called in the trade. The third thing that you want that you might want to save is ecosystems. That maybe you want to draw a lesson from a lot of work in social studies of science and other fields and say, well, maybe the ecosystem itself is a valuable thing to keep and that there's no such thing as an entity which exists outside of its setting. So just the genetic information is useless. So this approach, and it's modeled in many other spheres right now, is an approach to collapse three different value systems into a single currency, and that currency can then be used with policymakers to determine the future. All right. Okay, I'm going a little bit over here, but Bruce has kindly lent me a few minutes as well. Now, I want to talk about how do you travel then between the local and the global within the networks of information that the biodiversity scientists and urban and regional planners and other folks like that are creating right now. You do things with space and you do things with time. You create a space, first of all, which looks as if it's a universal space, looks as if it's everything that's out there and is in fact very restricted and local space. This is the discipline now called viewshed analysis. Viewshed analysis is, imagine you're, in this case, imagine you're, you know, living on that road along there. We want to know what you can see from various points along the ridge. And if we leave the forests in the areas of your proximal vision and your distant vision, then really doesn't matter what we do in between, because you're never going to go there, you're not going to see it, we can clear cut the forest, we can do whatever we like, but you'll be traveling through a world that looks for all the world to you like it's a natural landscape. It's done in Canada right now. Those of you that have driven the highways up there, which unfortunately I've not done, is that they leave a swath of forest by the side of the freeways, so that you're convinced that you're driving through forest and you can't see the clear cutting, which is about 50 meters away. This is one way of, not so much, what you're doing in this case is merging multiple temporalities, merging multiple agendas, and you're allowing yourself to each community that's a stakeholder in this gets the impression that they're living in a plenum, in a very full world, in a very complete world. But in fact, they're living in a highly particularized world. There's another case which I won't go into much detail. Oh, there's a bit of viewshed analysis for you. There's another one I won't go into much detail now, which is about the caribou in Canada, where the three constituents are the caribou, the clear cutters, and the caribou, the clear cutters, and the snowboarders. And what's been created there through the plan is a nature where the snowboarders think it's just a snowboarding environment. The caribou are pretty stupid; they don't realise anything's going on, and the clear cutters have their way. Now, in order to do this, to break things down into a single currency, what's needed? Well, you need a single spatiality, and we saw the trick that was involved there in viewshed analysis, which allows you to create a single a multiple spatiality, but represent it for each community as a single and full spatiality. This is one of my favorite quotes from Thomas Pynchon's wonderful novel, The Mason and Dixon. Mr. Swivett, approaching a facial lividity that would alarm a physician were one present, now proclaims, not only did they insult the God-given structure of the year, they also put us on Catholic time, French time. We've been fighting France all of our lives, all of our fathers' lives. France is the enemy eternal. Why be ruled by their calendar? This is a reference to the event some of you may not know. In the 1780s, the English calendar was brought into line with the European calendar, which meant that 11 days were lost. And there were riots in the streets of London, you know, kind of demanding those 11 days back. You know, you've taken 11 days out of our lives, you know, that's, you know, you've got no right to do that, especially because the French are doing it. And Pynchon has a wonderful riff on that in the book. Because their philosophers and ours, explains Mr. Hailstone, are all in league with those in other states of Europe and the Jesuits too, among them possessing machines, powders, rays, elixirs and such, none less than remarkable. One now and then so daunting that even the agents of kings must stay their hands. Time, ye see, says the landlord, is the money of science, isn't it? The philosophers need a time common to all, as traders do a common coinage, suggesting as well an interest in those events which could occur in several parts of the globe at the same instant. Now, this attempt to create a universal time or an appearance of universal time within very large-scale databases is very similar to the move that's made and spatiality that we were talking about before. This is 1 million years BC. I've chosen the one of the more interesting passages, which goes from 499,000, I can't quite see the bottom right. Really, you know, some really neat stuff in there. But in a way, this is how we see ourselves as organizing knowledge. And that's the ultimate goal of a lot of our knowledge production within the sciences, is about fitting things onto a single universal timeline. That's going to be something which is going to make interdisciplinary science possible. On the field, how easy is that? In the field, it's extremely difficult. This is one attempt to impose a universal timeline. It's the geological time scale from the decade of North American geology. I think that's the 1987 timeline. Now, the problem with this is that timelines change by community, by specific interests. So you get groups of paleontologists who have a certain fossil lineage, but even if the Geological Society of America folks say, hey, you know, that's not right anymore, we should, you know, you need to push up the Oligocene or something, they will not accept that change because it doesn't accord with their current set of data. And when we look at that attempt to produce a single universal timeline, it's always an imperialist endeavor. I can go into a lot more details about that if anyone's interested. It's always an imperializing endeavor. It's always problematic, and there are always machineries for producing difference. Universal timelines always splinter for very good organizational and very good social reasons. Yeah, that one I can do a lot more detail on. That's the caribou, which I'm going to ignore. Okay, so a couple of conclusions. The changing of metaphors, and it didn't unfold too gracefully, the changing of metaphors in alignment with IT changes. This is something I pointed out very early, and I know I've just given kind of indications of an area here. I haven't had the detail to really push through some of these points. But if you go from the early botanical databases, they were strictly hierarchical. You navigated your way through them. You went from the, from the root point, and you continued traveling until you found a leaf that you were after. We're now moving more and more into kind of object-oriented databases. We're going away from a central metaphor for understanding the Earth and understanding changes in the Earth, from that being an archival representation. And Charles Lyell, who did wrote the Principles of Geology, has wonderful passages on the Earth as a record keeper and the Earth as an archivist. But we're moving away from that metaphor. We're moving away from the metaphor of the tree of life into the web of life. Now, what's happening there, there's a couple of ways you can read this. One standard scientific line is to say, well, the discovery is coming from scientists about the nature of reality, and it's then trickling down into other spheres like computer science, like the humanities. Another reading, one which I actually prefer by far, is to say that what's happening here is that you get single sets of information problems which occur in loads of different domains over time, and we're a single culture, we are not two cultures. And sometimes solutions will come from the science side, sometimes they'll come from the art side, sometimes from humanities. But we're all thinking together within very common problematics right now about time and about spatiality in a whole set of different domains. So in a sense you can see the IT itself as being a driver, the IT for Lyell being the archive and the IT for current work being the web, being object orientation. Okay, so that's point one, fairly trivial point. Point two, the regimes of particularity and regimes of implosion. Now, the regime of particularity, which we saw at the beginning, this incredibly full tree of life, incredible detail, however far you want to bore down in it, you will get as much detail as you could ever want to know about the universe. We often look at the internet and we look at new information technologies in terms of this explosive regime of particularity, and we get the impression when we look out in the information world and the data world, well, that's a full world, because any question I can possibly think of can be met in that world. What we don't pay enough attention to is, I think, that there is always a tension and a dramatic tension between regimes of particularity and regimes of implosion. Regimes of implosion being attempts like the one I described to collapse everything down into a single currency, collapse multiple discourses into a single token which can be exchanged, bartered for, swapped, and so on and so forth. Those regimes of implosion for me within the emerging information infrastructures constitute the sort of shell game that Latour talks about in We Have Never Been Modern, for those of you that know that work. Okay, finally then, actually not quite finally, implosion in particularity. Implosion is about managing multiple discourses. It's always a highly political and ethically charged site. It's about competing localisms. Competing localisms cannot exist on the web. They cannot exist in these very large databases without a hell of a lot of backstage management being done and a hell of a lot of second order discourse, which is highly theoretically and politically charged theoretical discourse going on. And I suggest, or rather I believe, that we need a poetics of databases in order to be able to tackle this sort of global question. I want to finish with, this is a Lukasa memory device. Since I was very ashamed the other day, I didn't give the full details on it. Lukasa memory devices provide a framework for history while permitting multiple interpretations of it. Madubi court historians associate memories with particular loci on a Lukasa. Through a rectangular or hourglass shape that represents the Luba landscape, the royal court, human anatomy, and the emblematic royal tortoise all at once, the memory board embodies multiple levels of information simultaneously. Beads coded by size and color, an incised or raised ideogram, provide a means to evoke events, places, and names in the past. Now, I'm bookending this with the money as the degree zero of information at the very beginning of the talk. This is the degree total of information. This is a form of implosion which makes every local discourse visible, and every local discourse feeds in with each other in very interesting ways. And I think we have the choice right now between, certainly in biodiversity science, between two kinds of implosion. We can either implode towards the currency and end up with a highly weighted playing field, which is going to work very well for the Western countries and is going to keep me in hot tubs for the rest of my life. Or we can implode in the other way, implode something of the order of the Lukasa memory device, and I wish I knew how to do that. Thank you.